The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Government attorney is advising an agency head or the chief executive. For example, when the Justice Department is representing the position of the president in court, does it have a different ethical consideration to it to be a full, complete advocate on behalf of the president and the president's policy than when the Department of Justice is giving the president advice on a particular course of conduct, that is, in making the president aware of all the arguments of a legal question, including the public interest perspective, regardless of the president's policy? On August 1, 2002, then Assistant Attorney General Bybee signed off on and sent a memo drafted by Assistant Attorney General John Yoo to White House Counsel Alberto Gonzalez about the UN Convention Against Torture and the U.S. statutes embodying that convention with respect to the mistreatment of Iraqi and Afghan prisoners. The Assistant Attorney General in that memo said he was looking for, and these are his words, possible defenses that would negate any claim that certain interrogation methods violate the statute. Bybee and you concluded that cruel, inhuman, and degrading conduct would not violate the convention because it did not create the requisite level of pain. And they concluded that, and these are their words, there is a wide range of sensory deprivation techniques that will not rise to the level of torture. The Assistant Attorney General also concluded that, quote, necessity or self-defense may justify interrogation that might violate the law. The memo created a firestorm when it was leaked to the press in June of 2004, both for what it said, that the president could violate the law and the UN Convention, and for what it did not say, that it left out the consideration of important cases and opposing points of view on the subject. It appeared to be a document prepared by government lawyers in response to the question, how can we do this, as opposed to a document responding to the question, can or should we do this? The memo was rescinded in December 2004. But for us, what are the ethical implications of a government attorney preparing a document like that, the so-called Biden memo? We have a distinguished panel of speakers to address the questions and these types of questions, and it's my privilege to introduce them this morning, which I will do in a minute, but first I want to summarize the format that we're going to use today. Each speaker will talk for 15 minutes on an aspect of our topic, and after all four speakers have finished, we will invite questions from both the panel and from the audience. I encourage you, therefore, to please write down your questions for each speaker as we go along so you don't forget as we before we get to the end I hope we will have a lively and engaging conversation and dialogue at the end of the presentation. And now I'd like to introduce the speakers in the order that they will make their presentations. Judge William Webster, Jesselyn Radek, Kathleen Clark, and Joseph Bowman. First, let me introduce Judge William Webster. Judge Webster is our first speaker, and he served as Director of Central Intelligence from 1987 to 1991, and as Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation from 1978 to 1987. He was a judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit from 1973 to 1978, and of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Missouri. He also served for 2 years as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Missouri. He's a graduate of Amherst College and received his Juris Doctor from Washington University Law School, Kathleen Clark Foundation. He has received numerous honorary degrees and awards, including the Freedom Foundation National Service Medal, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the National Security Medal, and the 2002 ABA Medal, which is the ABA's highest honor. Most recently, he was given the prestigious William Donovan OSS Award, and he is currently a senior partner in the law firm of Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCoy, and serves as the Vice Chairman for the Advisory Council on Homeland Security. Judge Webster, it's a privilege to have you here today, and I give you the floor.
Thank you. Well, it's nice to be here on such an interesting topic. And in trying to carve out a place for myself, but in the presence of these experts on who have really scrutinized ethical issues, first plead ignorance other than working on the ALI program. FBI and CIA, and in other areas where we've had to address policy and legal considerations at the White House and otherwise. Everyone, when they mentioned the question of who do lawyers and government represent, it's not too distant from the question that often presents itself to an attorney doing work for a corporation. Does he represent, or she represent, the officers, CEO, the officers? Does he represent the directors? Or does he represent the shareholders? And I think that the general conclusion is that the lawyer is first and foremost attorney for the company, and the company with all its components to whom he has an obligation to perform as a lawyer. If you have a single individual, you know who you're representing. In other cases, in the private sector, that presents a problem, and that's why we have provisions for derivative litigation, so that shareholders can complain about the failure of their management to do what they should do. And the government is not far removed. But as I said, I'm speaking in part, maybe in mainly, as a consumer of legal services, and I may not be as exact as under any set of legal ethical principles, but it has seemed to me that the broad answer to that question for government attorneys is that the client is the Constitution of the United States. It is to the Constitution that we take our oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and to bear true faith and allegiance to the same. And I think that that oath is mainly used. It's used in the military. It's used in civilians for all ranks and services. And that is a beacon by which to navigate. Sometimes we say it's our moral compass, but it's more than that. We have an obligation to navigate by the Constitution. And often it's in tough situations where there are heavy policy pressures to find ways around difficult situations. It is the lawyer's allegiance to the Constitution that keeps him from looking for ways to duck, bob, and weave, which is not ever in the longest range best interests of the American people or of our government. Sometimes this comes from those being in authority who really lack information constitutional rights. And I said, that's very good. And you also told them those rights include the right to silence. He said, well, no, I said, I would. So I went through the process. In any event, we went out to sea, and we arrived in Japan 2 weeks later. And there was a letter waiting for us, going up as only military could do, via, was a letter from the admiral who was commanded the Navy base at Pearl Harbor, through the commandant of the 14th Naval District, through the, also an admiral, through the Commander Service for Pacific Fleet, also an admiral. Bottom line was that due to Lieutenant Webster's interference, we had been unable to obtain a confession. And the captain put the letter down, and he said, you write my response and I'll sign it. So I wrote a response, and I pointed out the legal position, which they could clearly read in the Uniform Code, and which was just about to be adopted, and the Naval Courts, of course, and referred to the principle of presumption of innocence. And they sent it on, and then it went back through, and finally another letter came back with all the VVVs. And Admiral Denenbrink, the Commander Service Force, the bottom line was that in doing what he did, Lieutenant Webster had done no more than to guarantee to these men the rights assured to them by the Constitution of the United States. And those wonderful words, no further action contemplated. Well, I mention that only because when you're in an organization where there's a clear chain of command, there's a tendency to want to override opinions and decisions, advocacy or advice that you don't like, and you're not used to other facts. I tried later on at Guam. I was asked to serve on a shortage of lawyers. I was asked to serve on a special court martial, and the evidence in was very insufficient. I think this case should be dismissed, but the members of the court martial will say, yes, but you know, the admiral wants a different result. And it took a while for me to make sure that they understood that their responsibilities were different than doing what the admiral wanted. Now, that's been corrected in the military system, and the judge advocate gets these cases directly rather than having the commanding officer set the rules for how what the outcome will be. I mention that because these things are not exactly uniform. When you have those who advise and those who are charged with putting the government's best case forward, may sometimes be different. In fact, I learned not long ago that Irwin Griswold, Solicitor General for many years, and of course the great dean of law school at Harvard, that this model Solicitor General had been responsible for separating out the Office of Legal Counsel from the Solicitor General's office because of the apparent differences, at least the appearance of differences, between someone who had to advocate and someone who had to give the best honest advice to the president that could be given in a particular situation. Including the pratfalls, the pitfalls, and on the other hand, which you don't normally hear in a Solicitor General's argument before the Supreme Court. So I recognize that there are differences, and I think it's we'll hear from others talking about those as we go along. thing was we were then on very tender ground. Congressmen began to wonder whether or not the executive branch was had Congress under attack or targeted. And so we had to be absolutely sure that you could defend our legal position. This technique has been well used in organized crime and well used in drug activities. It had never really been employed in corruption cases before. And I went out of my way to be sure that that we had clearly defined legal principles. We did not want entrapment to become an issue, especially when there was a feeling of paranoia among members of Congress at the time. So again, I set out a couple of rules that I thought would help protect us. I said the corrupt metal men should be told that the sheik, which is us, did not want to sell anyone on this act. If they brought somebody there, they should know, the person should already know the criminal activity. We wouldn't express that in those terms, but the corrupt metal men. They said, we don't invite them coming here that want to do business with the sheik. And then the next set of instructions were, when you have the secret meeting, videotape, be sure that you talk dirty so that an innocent person wanders in, misled by the corrupt metal man. He would soon know that he was in a place he did not belong. And the third one was, if he wants to leave, let him leave. If he's corrupt, he'll be back again. But if he's there by mistake, we don't want to be responsible by sweetening the deal by keeping him around when he does not belong and come to risk entrapment. And then for additional precaution, we arranged to have a lawyer who's been very successful in New York in subsequent years, Tom Puccio, who was a Justice Department official, watch the whole proceeding on closed circuit video, and then he could place a phone call to the sheik's representative in a protectful phone call. He'd answer the phone, yes, so forth, and then Puccio would say, you're getting too close, or you could get a lot closer, which was the case in most of them. Bottom line, we were able to sustain 14 petitions for certiorari to the United States Supreme Court. We won every case. By that time, the public and Congress understood that we knew what we were doing. And while it was going on, I stuck my neck out and authorized a similar undercover investigation against the judges in Cook County called Rayleigh. Over 100 indictments came down. One of the out-of-state judges carried a microphone in his boot and reported bribery situations. It was a very interesting case. But what was important to protect the technique, and it was important to protect people who might become involved who there by mistake and innocent. These are the kinds of things that I think government lawyers have a responsibility to do. They also have a responsibility to tell their boss when they believe their boss is wrong or about to do something that he should not be allowed to do. There are many stories, and I see I'm running into maybe we get to the end of this or maybe some more, but I won't give you any more examples than I have. But I think those who use legal services must understand that responsibility and encourage their legal departments or their individually assigned lawyers that that's exactly the kind of information that they want. Pretty much summed up, in my view, in the rather sad autobiography by Richard Kleindienst, who was caught in the Watergate probe to the Attorney General, never really, as far as I know, participated in any of those activities, but for one reason or other, caught the fire and played havoc with his career, and he resigned. But when he wrote this book, analyzing the various situations, at the very end, he was talking about John Dean, who was the president's counsel, a very young man whom I knew well because I was handling the estate in which his first wife was one of the principal beneficiaries of a large matter. is old enough, mature enough, and strong enough to say, when appropriate, Mr. President, you cannot do that. It is illegal. And that was what was missing in the Watergate case. So if I had to sum up what I think the role of a lawyer is the ability to stand up to enormous power and pressure and say, when he knows or she knows the action proposed violates the Constitution or the laws of the United States, to put that before the people who are involved. I think that's a good place for
that. Excellent. Thank you so much, Jessalyn. Next, we'll hear from Jessalyn Radick. We have our other three panelists all graduated from Yale University Law School, as it turns out. After graduating from Yale, Jessalyn joined the Justice Department through the Attorney General's Honor Program. She practiced constitutional tort litigation for 4 years and then served as legal advisor to the Professional Responsibility Advisory Office for 3 years. She resigned from the Justice Department and blew the whistle on ethical misconduct in the case of the so-called American Taliban, John Walker Lynn. As a result, she was fired from her next job. She was placed under criminal investigation, referred to the state bars in which she was licensed, and she was put on the no-fly list. The criminal case closed with no charges being brought, and the Maryland Bar Association dismissed the case against her. She currently works with the ADA Task Force on Treatment of Enemy Combatants and was recently elected to the D.C. Bar's Legal Ethics Committee. She has written extensively on legal ethics and counterterrorism and will be adjunct teaching legal ethics here at the Washington College of Law next semester. Jessalyn, it's nice to have you.
Thank you, Linda. While my focus today is not on the whistleblowing you mentioned in Linda's introduction, I'll mention very briefly that the ABA has expanded Model Rule 1.6, which governs confidentiality. And it expanded the exceptions to confidentiality specifically to contemplate and encourage whistleblowing and to comply with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002. What I'd like to speak about, however, is the role of the government attorney, and in particular, the role of the government advisor. I was a government advisor, but what really brought me to this topic was the revelation of the so-called torture memos in 2004. As Linda mentioned earlier, those memos were rescinded, but I want to mention that they were not rescinded until after they became public and after the Abu Ghraib prison abuse scandal broke. And even once they had been disavowed by the administration, it took 6 months to rescind them. The memos, however, put legal ethics in sharp relief and begged the question of the proper role of the government advisor. So I will throw out a little hypothetical to think about while I discuss this. And this hypothetical occurs within the government. I'm not talking about private attorneys here. A client asks this lawyer a question. During an interrogation of a suspected terrorist, how much pain can I legally inflict? The lawyer should A, explore every legal avenue available for his client, including all possible defenses, should criminal charges be filed. B, give legal guidance, but add advice on the wisdom and morality of what the client is considering. Or C, tell the client to take a walk. The lawyers at the Justice Department who prepared the so-called torture memos apparently chose the first option. This begs the question of what is the proper role for the government attorney advisor. As an initial matter, and both Judge Webster and Linda have alluded to this, scholarship, legislation, and case law are all in agreement that the government lawyer has a higher duty than your private attorney. This was first articulated in case law in the Supreme Court case of United States versus Berger in 1938, controversy, but of a sovereignty whose obligation to govern impartially is as compelling as its obligation to govern at all. And its interest, therefore, in a criminal prosecution is not that it shall win a case, but that justice shall be done. Similar sentiment has been expressed on the civil side, too. It's fairly universally accepted among government lawyers that you do have a greater duty to the public, in part because you have the imprimatur of the United States behind you, and because you have the vast resources of the United States government. Most government lawyers are guided by three different approaches. One is the agency approach, and the other is the public interest approach. Basically, both are valid, but I submit to you today that one approach is more appropriate for litigating, and the other approach is more appropriate for advising. The threshold question for both approaches is who is the client. Other people today have talked about the fact that there can be a number of different clients, a government as a whole, the executive branch, a particular agency like the Department of Justice, your supervisor, the Constitution, or the public at large. Under the agency approach, the agency is the client. This approach has been espoused by the patriarchs of legal ethics, including Monroe Friedman and my legal ethics professor, Jeff Hazard. It emphasizes the duties of loyalty, zeal, and confidentiality. Zealous advocacy has been taken out of the actual Rule 1.3, which governs diligence, but it's still found in the commentary and still very much informs the folklore of the profession. It allows for narrow advice, almost a militant, no holds barred kind of advocacy, and it would permit you to exploit any gap or ambiguity, technicality, or loophole in the law, as long as you're giving a non-frivolous argument. It's exactly what most people would want in a courtroom. It also sees the lawyer as a detached counselor. It frowns on the lawyer making value judgments and doesn't want the lawyer to be paternalistic in trying to influence the client in any kind of way. And there are a number of benefits to this agency approach. Easy applicability of the ethics codes is one of them, which is very important because it treats private attorneys and government attorneys the same, and that it's good to have easy application of the ethics rules, particularly in the government. After the 1999 McDade Amendment, government attorneys now have to abide by not only their own state bar rules, but the bar rules of any jurisdiction in which they litigate. So anything that simplifies the application of the ethics rules is good. The agency approach also provides clear lines of authority, where only senior agency officers and officials control. And this works particularly well, in theory, in an administration like the Bush administration, where you have a very corporate, top-down hierarchy of people. It also has been credited with providing increased democratic accountability because final authority rests with political appointees or with the president. And numerous people have credited it with helping to implement executive policy. On the other hand, you have a public interest approach. This takes that the client is the public, or the people, or the common good, or the citizenry. It's a broader view and a more amorphous view in many people's minds. It espouses that the duty of the lawyer is to innocent third parties and to the court and to the public. It allows for broader advice that considers policy and moral issues and evaluates whether an action is fair and just. It wants the lawyer to weigh in on the wisdom and morality and the consequences of what the client is doing. Basically, basically the benefits of this approach is that it is consistent with what mostly lawyers who work for the government view as their higher duty that I discussed before. It also prevents abuse of position because your government attorney is ultimately accountable to the people, not to his or her boss. Again, I don't think either of these changes need to be, not either of these approaches should be changed. I think they're both valid. My suggestion instead is that we give primacy to the public interest approach when rendering advice, especially on morally perilous questions like torture. Government advisors are, it's not just torture, I mean, that's the most obvious example, but government attorneys are often giving advice on morally perilous questions like the constitutionality of a euthanasia law or the constitutionality of an abortion, late-term abortion law, or political asylum questions. And the torture memos were justified to the extent that they were defended. They were justified by a very classic agency approach. To the extent that they have been defended, it's been, look, this is what lawyers do. My law school classmate, John Yu, who was the primary author of one of the most incendiary of them, says that he wasn't making a value judgment for or against torture, but it was simply providing objective counsel, exploring how far the law would let the administration go. He was just letting the client know the full range of options. On the other hand, advisors don't usually advocate or oppose an agency's policy. Instead, they evaluate them for constitutionality, as Judge Webster explains. Sometimes they're evaluating them for ethical soundness, but they're not advocating or opposing the issue. My bottom line that I would like you to take away today is that the agency approach is better suited to advocates, and the public interest approach is better suited to advisors. Neither approach is wrong, but the agency approach is more appropriate to advocates or litigators because there is an adversary system in place. You have two opposing gladiators dueling it out before a neutral judge. Both sides of the issue get presented. But advisors are usually giving advice in private. It is not subject to any kind of adversarial challenge or judicial review. It's one-sided, it's secret, and it's not overseen by a neutral decision-maker. Rule 2.1, which governs the advisor, is the same in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., which is where I assume most people taking this for CLE credit are from. It states that in representing a client, a lawyer shall exercise independent professional judgment and render candid advice. In rendering advice, a lawyer may refer not only to law, but to other considerations, such as moral, economic, social, and political factors that may be relevant to the client's situation. Now, there are not many provisions in the rules that are specific to government attorneys. That one is not specific. 3.8, which governs the special responsibility of prosecutors, or 1.13, which governs the organization as client, specifically talk about government lawyers. While the Rule 2.1 on advisors is permissive and not mandatory, and is not specific to government attorneys, and does not say when these other considerations should come into play, I'll tell you when. I believe that they come into play when you're an advisor for the government, especially when you're advising on morally perilous questions.
Our third speaker is Kathleen Clark. Kathleen writes about ethics and national security law and teaches in Washington University's Congressional and Administrative Law Clinic in Washington, D.C. Another graduate of Yale Law School, Kathleen clerked for U.S. District Court Judge Harold Green and served as counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. is chair-elect of the National Security Law Section of the Association of American Law Schools and serves on the board of the Service Members Legal Defense Network, which is working to end the military ban on gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. Kathleen, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much, Linda. And I want to thank Brad Moss and the other organizers of this panel for the opportunity to be here today. I'm going to first talk a little bit about what Jeff and Radek just described, and then discuss the August 1, 2002 torture memo, and then come back to Jeff Webster's remarks. Jeff and Radek described two different approaches to government lawyering, or lawyering in general, the agency approach and the public interest approach, and asserts that the public interest approach should be privileged when dealing with morally perilous questions. I think in her paper, Justin does a really nice job of reviewing some of the literature on this subject. And I agree that it is appropriate and necessary sometimes for a lawyer to provide moral analysis where the client, in particular, seems to be lacking moral grounding. The ethics rules, as Justin indicates, certainly provide that lawyers are conflict lawyers providing more than just technical legal advice for their clients. But I believe that the problem with the August 1, 2002 Justice Department memo on torture isn't simply that it took an agency approach instead of a public interest approach. Isn't that the lawyers didn't provide moral analysis. That memo did not even accurately describe the law in giving advice to the client. And that's what I'm going to talk about. The issue of the contents of that memo, the inaccuracies in that memo, in its legal analysis, and the legal ethics implications of those inaccuracies. First, I want to talk about the three major inaccuracies in this memorandum. The first major inaccuracy is that the memo asserts that the federal criminal statute which prohibits torture applies only where a government official specifically intends to and actually causes pain so severe that it, quote, rises to the level that would ordinarily be associated with death, organ failure, or serious impairment of bodily function. Now, this claim standard is bizarre. It's bizarre in the first place because organ failure is not necessarily even associated with pain. In addition, this standard is lifted from a statute that's entirely unrelated to torture. It's actually lifted from a Medicare statute, setting out the conditions under which hospitals have to provide emergency care. That statute says that severe pain is one possible indicator that a person needs emergency medical care. And that statute also goes on to define emergency medical condition as one in which failure to provide the medical care could result in serious jeopardy of an individual's health, impairment of bodily function, or serious dysfunction of any bodily organ or part. The torture memo lifts that standard from the Medicare statute and twists it so that severe pain only occurs in connection with serious physical condition or injury that would result in death, organ failure, or serious impairment of body function. So that's the first problem. It defines torture so very narrowly and does so in this way that's completely out of context. claim as the settled law of the land. It does not present either the counter-arguments to these claims or an assessment of the risk that other legal actors, including courts, would reject those claims. So having identified those three major inaccuracies, I want to talk about the legal ethics implications of those inaccuracies. It's important first to make a couple of preliminary observations. As Jeff Lombreda indicated, lawyers who work for the federal government are subject to state ethics rules. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, Attorney General Thornburg and Reno had asserted that the Constitution's Supremacy Clause gave the Justice Department the authority to exempt its lawyers from operation of the state ethics rules. But in 1998, Congress passed the McDade Amendment, making it clear that federal government lawyers must comply with state ethics rules. The two authors of the torture memo, Jay Bybee and John Yoo, both of them are subject to the D.C. rules of professional conduct. Bybee is a member licensed by D.C., and so directly subject to those rules. John Yoo is licensed by the state of Pennsylvania, but is subject to the D.C. rules by operation of the McDade Amendment because he practiced in D.C. when he worked at the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department. Okay, so first of all, they're subject to the state ethics rules in this case, among other things, D.C. The second observation is that, and this again comes back to Jeff's point, it's absolutely essential to determine whether a lawyer is acting as a legal advisor or as an advocate. Different rules apply to those different roles, to those distinct functions. When acting as an advocate before a tribunal, a lawyer can make just about any legal argument as long as it's not frivolous. Her only obligation of candor with regard to legal arguments is that if her opponent fails to mention directly adverse controlling authority, she needs to bring it to the tribunal's attention. When a lawyer gives legal advice, on the other hand, she has a professional obligation of candor towards the client. In advising a client, the lawyer's role is not simply to spin out creative legal arguments. It is to offer her assessment of the law as objectively as possible. And as Jeff Lombreda indicated, one finds that professional obligation in Model Rule 2.1 and the state's equivalent. So, in giving legal advice, a lawyer can provide advice that's contrary to the weight of authority, spinning out imaginative or, as they would say in this administration, forward-leaning legal theories to the client's views. But in doing so, the candor obligation requires the lawyer to inform the client that the weight of authority contrary to that advice and that other legal actors may come to the opposite conclusion. The torture memo, the August 1, 2002 memo from the Office of Legal Counsel purports to be legal advice. So its authors, Jay Bybee and John Yoo, had an obligation to be candid with their client, the executive branch. The constituent who requested the torture memo, then White House Counsel Alberto Gonzalez, may have wanted a particular answer to his question about the application of the torture statute. But the OLC lawyers, the Justice Department's lawyers, had a professional obligation to give accurate legal advice to their client, whether the client's constituent, Gonzalez, wanted to hear it or not. It appears to me that Jay Bybee, who now sits on the Ninth Circuit, and John Yoo, failed to give candid legal advice and violated D.C. Rule 2.1. If bar disciplinary authorities decide to investigate John Yoo and Jay Bybee, they will have the opportunity to explain or defend their actions. I guess I just want to add that Bybee and you are not the only government lawyers implicated by the torture memo. Several White House lawyers reviewed drafts of the memo. I don't know whether those White House lawyers objected to the flawed analysis of the torture memo or whether they actually insisted on such flawed analysis. Other Bush administration lawyers April 2003. Now, not all government lawyers accepted the patently inaccurate claims in this memo. And there are some heroes in this story that I think deserve some added attention. Career military lawyers who were involved in developing that Defense Department interrogation policy objected to the torture memo and went up the chain of command to register their objections. The contrast between the action of those career military lawyers and the politically appointed lawyers is really quite striking. And I think this is worthy, that comment is worthy of a lot more detailed study as more facts become public. In fact, we didn't have access to this JAG, the military memos, until this summer. I think it may have been Senator Levin had requested them, and they were finally published. Finally, let me come back to Judge Webster's remarks. I was struck by Judge Webster's long-term perspective when he was talking about the Alcium prosecution, about that his goal wasn't just to get convictions, but he was also concerned about maintaining the process, maintaining the FBI's ability to use, I guess not entrapment, but something less than, different from entrapment. And it seems to me that those JAG lawyers who objected to the torture memo and objected to that faulty analysis took a similar kind of long-term institutional perspective, quite loyal to their institutional clients. One place where I would have a different perspective than Judge Webster is that Judge Webster said that, in his view, the client is the Constitution. And I have a slightly different gloss on this. I believe that the client is the entity, the executive branch of government. But that client is very different from the ordinary client in the private sector, because that client is constrained by the Constitution. So when the representative of that client, the president, says, I want a memo saying that I can authorize torture, the lawyer has an obligation not just to do the bidding of the client's representative, in this case the president or the president's lawyer, but has an obligation to remind the client that the client itself is constrained by the Constitution. Again, going back to Judge Webster's remarks and findings, saying that the president needs a lawyer who's mature enough to say, Mr. President, you cannot do that, it's illegal. It seems to me that the breaches with regard to U.S. detention policy and torture is actually much more serious than the problems that the lawyers had in Watergate. In this sense, the United States has been torturing people, has been waterboarding and engaging in torture, guided by this torture memo. And so there are individuals who have been very concretely harmed by U.S. policy and policy that was helped through the assistance of these lawyers. And so I think the situation, as I say, is quite serious, and it's just a shame that the politically appointed lawyers in this administration did not have the kind of maturity that Mr. Finding referred to.
Thank you, Kathleen. Our closer today is Joe Onik, a senior policy analyst at the Open Society Institute and senior counsel at the Constitution Project in Washington, D.C. A graduate of Yale Law School, he has practiced in both public interest and private law firms in the areas of constitutional law and health law. He first served in government as a law clerk to Chief Judge David Babylon of the District of Columbia Circuit and Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, and as a Senate staffer. In the Carter administration, he served as a member of the White House Domestic Policy Staff, and then as Deputy Counsel to the President. In the Clinton administration, he served as Principal Deputy Associate Attorney General
Solicitor General argues on behalf of the government in the Supreme Court, and typically will defend as constitutional any statute passed by the Congress. But on occasion, the Solicitor General, as a member, of course, of the executive branch of the Justice Department, makes a determination that a statute passed by Congress is unconstitutional and refuses to defend it in the Supreme Court. That, needless to say, causes a ruckus in the Congress, and in fact, Congress has enacted legislation to deal with that situation procedurally. The Solicitor General has to notify the Congress that he, or one of these days she, is not going to defend the statute, and Congress is given a separate opportunity to file before the court, to hire its own counsel, to argue on behalf of the constitutionality of the statute. So here is a situation where, in general, you don't think of the division that the Solicitor General faces, that he is client in the United States government. But when there are serious constitutional doubts at issue, the split becomes clear. He represents the executive branch, which is constrained, as Kathleen says, by the Constitution. And therefore, because of that constraint, refuses to appeal. He does not, in that situation, represent the Congress, and the Congress, if it so chooses, if it doesn't agree, as it sometimes does, with the Solicitor General's advice, can litigate separately. And there is a situation where I think the players recognize, A, that the branches of government are constrained by the Constitution, that lawyers cannot be expected to argue before the Supreme Court for the constitutionality of a statute if they do not believe that there's a non-frivolous argument that can be made on behalf of that statute, and that therefore it's delegated to the Congress itself to take on that duty if it wishes. Judge Webster also talked about his own experiences in the military and on in the days just before the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And I would like to touch on briefly an area where I believe that lawyers in this administration, I think, have not fulfilled their duties, whether it amounts to a violation under Section 2.1. I don't pretend to be enough of an expert. The Military Commission order of the President was an extraordinary order. It was almost word for word copied from FDR's order in 1942, relating to the famous Fearon case. The problem is, of course, that the world and the law have changed dramatically since 1942, not only through United Nations and Universal Declarations of Human Rights, but most important of all, because of the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which sought to deal with some of the worst problems inherent in military justice, chain of command problems, and the lack of civilian review. And it sets up a system in which there is greater independence by the JAG from any command influence. It also provides for civilian review. This was ignored by the lawyers, and I believe it included largely the counsel's office and perhaps the general counsel of DOD, but did not include the military lawyers. And therefore, they went ahead and issued a military commission order that established a military commission system which does not meet international norms of justice and does not meet the norms of our own UCMJ. They did that by freezing out the military lawyers, who immediately protested once this became public. The upshot of this failure, it may not only have been an ethical violation, or to paraphrase Talleyrand, who once said it's worse than a crime, it's a blunder. Whether or not this was an ethical violation, I'll leave for others to decide. A blunder of the highest order. have to be. And secondly, of course, there has not yet been a single military commission trial, and there are many of us who believe there never will be, because the procedures are so controversial. They have not yet been used. Among the most severe objectors were our legal brethren and sisters, the British, and of course, although some of the original people slated to be tried were British, no. The Brits have made so much fuss, there are no Brits. There is one Australian coming up, we'll see if Hicks is ever tried. So, as I said, this was worse than an ethical violation, it was a blunder. Where were the lawyers? How could they, by the way, they cited the 1942 commission that just copied it. The last line of the President Roosevelt's order said there should be no review, including no habeas. They copied that word for word. Of course, the Supreme Court held there was habeas in the Kieran case and heard that case. So how could they, were they overruling Kieran, these little lawyers writing this order? They did not think. They did not carry out their responsibility of candid advice or even competent advice. So if you want to talk about ethical issues, but also blunders, I think there's certainly one that we can look at. With respect to the August memo, I think perhaps enough has been said. I would like to speak very briefly about the Steele seizure case. There's been a lot of debate in the scholarly community about that. It is true, as you know, the memo never cited the Steele seizure case, and in particular Justice Jackson's famous opinion in that case, where he said that the president's power is at its lowest end when he attempts to act in the face of a contradictory constitutional statute. And Harold Coe testified about this in the Gonzales hearings. And Harold may have overstated somewhat when he said that that statute provided a clear guidance or whatever. And other people have come back and said, well, wait a minute. All it says is that president's powers at the lowest end. It doesn't say that he doesn't necessarily have the power. Furthermore, if you read the Jackson opinion, careful that Jackson did distinguish somewhat between the president's power in the strictly military sense, that is over armed services, or the president's power in the Steele seizure case, which he regarded as civilian, even though, of course, the president did it in the name of national security. So I think there is a debate about the absolute relevance of the Steele seizure case. But should that case have been cited? Can there be any doubt that it should have been cited? It clearly should have been cited, not only because it's the most important case in the field, but it's the case that lay people, intelligent lay people like the President of the United States, can understand, and because in the broad framework of things, it serves as a red light. After all, the basic facts of the case are the President of the United States in the Korean War, when thousands of Americans were killed, by the way, I believe more Americans were killed in Korea than in Vietnam, when thousands of Americans were being killed, says that he has to keep the steel mills running on behalf of the national security of the United States, and the court strikes it down. Now, as I said, Steele seizure case can be distinguished. And if John Yoo was ever brought before a D.C. panel, he would distinguish it in the ways that other commentators have done it and may be successful. But that case should have been cited because that's the kind of case which would get a lay client, whether it's the president or people at the Defense Department, to say, take notice, to recall that even in wartime, there are limits to what the president could do. Now, they might then decide that in this way or that way, they could go ahead with various activities. But that's the case that should have been there. It is at least the warning light, at least the yellow light, if not the red light. And I do believe that although some commentators may have overstated the significance of the Steele seizure case, you cannot overstate the fact that it clearly should have been cited and described in that memo. Finally, I'd like to call attention to one case which may be of interest given our concerns. It's the case of Peters v. Hobby, which some of you may know. Peters was a professor at Yale, once again. I believe his wife may have been my contrast professor, but I'm not sure, Ellie Peters. and he was a special consultant to the Department of then ATW on medical matters. Some charges were made against him. This was the McCarthy era, the 1950s, that he was a communist. He was brought before some loyalty review board, and without going into all the details, he was found to be disloyal, debarred from serving as a consultant, in procedures which he argued did not meet constitutional standards because he was never allowed to confront the informant or witnesses against him. He brought a constitutional challenge. The Solicitor General of the United States, Simon Sobeloff, refused to sign the brief for the United States or to participate in the argument. Instead, the head of the Civil Division made the argument and lost. The Supreme Court ducked the constitutional issue but found that the activities of the review board did not meet the standards of the executive order, and Peters was totally reinstated. The lawyer who argued the case, the Assistant Attorney General, was rewarded the next year with a seat on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. His name, by the way, was Warren Berger. I don't know what happened to that. To be fair, the Solicitor General also was rewarded, I guess. Simon Sobeloff, he was given a seat on the Fourth Circuit, in fact, the same year, 1956. Although certainly some people say that he had been or might have been a possible candidate for the Supreme Court, and that he gave up, you know, that he gave up that possibility. By the way, as I was just reviewing the case, I happened to see a sidebar which said that no member of the Fourth Circuit has ever served on the Supreme Court. We'll see whether that survives. We'll see whether that survives the next 6 months. I think the Fourth Circuit has risen in the estimation of the judge. But there's an example to raise the case, of a situation where a high-ranking official made a determination that a statute could not be defended constitutionally, that the position of the United States could not be defended, and took his stand. And by the way, of course, it was noticed even at the time, and of course by commentators, and of course noticed by the Supreme Court, that the Solicitor General of the United States had refused to argue the case. Whether that had any influence on the Supreme Court's decision, I don't know, but obviously it was not a silent, passive, it could appear that way, but it was not simply a silent, passive action, because it was one that, that spoke loudly. There are, just to wrap up, there clearly are things, not only basic facts that government lawyers have to attend to the Constitution of the United States and to the public, but that in fact there are various opportunities for them to take action. And if they fail to do so under certain circumstances, they can perhaps be held accountable under the ethics laws. But, and this was the point I think that Judge Webster made in the beginning, when they fail to do so, it is very, very rare, I think, that that is going to prove to be in the long-term interest of the United States. To go back to Talleyrand's line, worse than a crime is a blunder. There is no question that we would have been, to take the military commission example, far, far better off if, first of all, the government lawyers who made these decisions had conferred initially with military lawyers, which they failed to do, and second, if they heeded the advice of the military lawyers. The failure to do so, as I say, has led to the darkening of any reputation of Guantanamo and our efforts there, totally self-inflicted wound. Furthermore, I would say the same about the torture behind, and Catherine mentioned this. Again, worse than a crime of blunder. Abu Ghraib may haunt us in the United States and also the activities in Guantanamo for a generation, since Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo will be on the recruiting posters for terrorists perhaps for decades to come. Again, not just a crime, not just an ethical violation, but a blunder. So I think the most important important thing said here was really to heed to Webster's advice that you have to think a little beyond the immediate, you have to take the long run and look, and lawyers would play a crucial role in that. In this case, in the administration's case, in many areas, clearly they failed.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you for the entire panel for your enlightened, informed, and really quite impassioned presentations. They were very beneficial to all of us. Let me first turn to the panelists before I open the questions to the audience, the opportunity for questions to the audience, and ask the panelists if you have any comments on anything that was said by another panelist. Judge Webster, do you have any comments? I'll start with you.
I might have one or two. First of all, I don't think Kathleen and I are in disagreement on who our lawyers are. I was trying to simplify the all people who take the oaths of office in the government have an obligation, constitutional lawyers have an obligation to make sure their bosses are reminded of what their constitutional parties are. So I think we're appropriately aligned here. I could make a philosophical note in terms of our relationships between the three branches of government. We've heard issues of how the Solicitor General and the Congress gets a chance to reply and so on. In dealing with each other and in testimony where lawyers are always involved, it has seemed to me very important that we address the issue of correct and accurate testimony. My own agency, the CIA, at the end of, before I got there, the Iran-Contra period, had developed a reputation, deserved or undeserved, of being disingenuous, withholding, answering only questions in the narrowest possible way. And this was causing substantial damage to the trust that Congress had in the executive branch's representations to them. And so, to deal with that, I adopted something called the Four C's. So the guidance for people giving testimony before the Congress, particularly the intelligence committees, should be that even in closed sessions, it must always be correct, candid, complete, and consistent. And then through that, I said there will be many opportunities when you may not want to answer the question, because there are people in the room that you're not certain what they're doing there or how committed they are to preserve confidentiality in meetings, and you don't want to answer. Say so. Don't say you don't have an answer. Say you have an answer, but you're not authorized to give it. You go back to headquarters. Headquarters will work with staff to serve our mutual interests, including protection of sources and methods, and put that in place. And I'm very pleased that, at least to my knowledge, no member of Congress serving on intelligence issues from that day forward accused the CIA of lying, dissembling, or failing in its responsibilities. So those are, I think, truth builds trust at every stage of our relationship. And there, as lawyers have in their search for truth, a commitment to the truth and the importance of making sure that those they serve do not obfuscate in dealing with people who have an equal right to know the answer. You don't want, if you think they are reaching executive privilege, you should say so, but you shouldn't play games in that process. The other statement that I was reminded, and I've forgotten whether it was Jocelyn or Kathleen who made the observation about the commitment to doing justice rather than to getting commissions. There's a wonderful circular on entrance to the Attorney General's office, which is not always used, but it's there, and inscribed in wood on the circle of that is a statement by a former Solicitor General who happened to be from St. Louis, Frederick Lehman, back in, I think, I don't know whether most of those are all period, a long time ago. It just said, the United States wins its point whenever justice is done to one of its citizens in the court. And there's a constant need to remind, particularly these long-term independent counsel who justice to our citizens in court is paramount to the responsibility of what it is. That's about all I have to say.
Anyone else? Justin, you have
I would just add on to Kathleen in terms of people who are heroes in the torture story to the military lawyers. I would add the State Department lawyers were also a very strong dissenting voice. And the result was that a lot of these people were marginalized when they raised objections. And I think, as expressed clearly, for example, by the Department of Defense, Rumsfeld, we all need all these lawyers. They get in the way and they're like beavers. They dam up what we want to do and create all these roadblocks. And then whatever the instinct is to cut the lawyers out of the loop, do the opposite. It's all the more reason lawyers need to be involved. There are lawyers who try to do the right thing and got shot down. But as other people have pointed out, numerous people have stood up to questions of the United States in the past.
I actually have a question for Jeff Webster. I really enjoyed the various stories that you told. I was particularly intrigued by your conversation with Bill Casey. When he said, oh, he needs to keep the lawyers out of it, was he referring to Iran-Contra, or was it something else that he was referring to?
No, I think it was not case-specific.
Oh, okay.
General principles of the slow-down process, getting something done. Sometimes a little slow, a little slow down is not a bad idea. I wanted to say, on the issue of the torture, that I learned this morning that Porter Goss, the director of the CIA, had issued an internal memorandum stating that the CIA had not sought, nor did it need, an exemption for any kind of interrogation activity that might have taken place abroad. I don't, time will tell who generated that approach, and I'm sorry in a way that the facts didn't come out in terms of what did Senator McCain say and so on, but I'm very pleased because we struggled to remind everyone in the agency that while many of the things they do and of necessity must do abroad do not comport with the laws of the countries where espionage is illegal and everything they do conflicts with some issue if that's understood. But in the United States, they are not outside the Constitution in any way.
Well, this is the opportunity now then for those of you in the audience to ask your questions of the panelists. Please just raise your hand and I'll acknowledge your questions. Yes?
I have two short comments and then a question for Kathleen. First comment is for Joseph. I think that the commissions, that there have been motions hearing right now on one of the cases.
Yeah, okay.
For Jocelyn, your balancing of the agency approach versus the public interest approach, it seems to me, and perhaps it's because I'm an agency attorney, that it seems to be a bit activist, the public interest approach. That while I'm not above or beyond giving my moral position on a particular topic, I think that attempting to go farther than merely giving my opinion smacks of activism that someone who's been confirmed by the Senate has more popular backing in that sense than I am. So I'm certainly not unwilling to give my opinion, but I'm not a nanny, I'm an advisor. And my question to Kathleen is, in your Washington Post article that was included in the materials here, you state that the Convention Against Torture Congress had the authority to create such a statute prohibiting it, and under Youngstown Steel, whether or not the president is editorial exempt, but rather, I believe, as Joseph alluded to, that whether or not Youngstown Steel and this torture statute together stands the proposition that the president, in his constitutional authority, has no authority to either permit under his commander-in-chief powers, or that the defense of necessity, which has been addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court, and although it didn't expressly adopt it, did not implicitly or explicitly reject it, whether or not that defense would actually be available in a U.S. prosecution in the torture statute to a person who is alleged to have committed a torturous act under the statute.
I made a mistake. Could I also ask you to identify yourself before you ask a question, just so that we know?
Sure, my name is Ross.
And do you want to identify what agency you're with?
I'm with the federal government.
Okay. All right.
The federal government.
OGA.
Could it be another government agency?
Kathleen, did you understand the question?
I think so, but I think Jeff said you wanted to.
Oh, okay.
I was just going to address Scott's question first. Part of the irony of this whole thing is that the agency approach is supposedly, in theory, supposed to constrain individual personalities and idiosyncratic loose cannons. But in point of fact, by all accounts, John Yoo was a maverick who was calling shots and who had quite a personality and was able to very much put forth his own personal view. When I talk about commenting on the wisdom or morality of something, that's not the wisdom and morality according to the Jessel and Great Act view of the world. That's more looking at what's in the public's interest. And I think for something like torture, when you hear universal condemnation and a communal outcry against it, it's easy to discern what the public interest is. And if there's still confusion for those who are not getting a sixth sense that torture is wrong, you can look to international as well as domestic law to kind of tease out what is in the public interest.
Yeah, to address your question about unilateral executive power and the necessity of that, I don't think that there would be improper for an executive branch lawyer to make some of these same arguments in a tribunal before a court. Seems to me that they would not be frivolous arguments. I don't think the lawyer would be sanctioned for making these arguments. My assessment of them, evaluation of them, is that they were inappropriately handled in the advising function, that they gave the client the wrong impression about the strength of these arguments and the probability of prevailing in a court or other legal actors taking a different perspective. Yes.
Could you identify yourself?
I'm Edward Williamson. I'm a partner of Sullivan & Cromwell. Several comments. First, I just sort of general comments on the panel. Is that I think you all have demonstrated why the agency approach is the correct approach as opposed to this public approach to Jocelyn. So I think what you've done is you've taken a substantive disagreement legal and policy position and have pushed it into an ethical issue. And I think you have come very, very close to falling into that terrible practice that we have here in Washington of trying to criminalize policy differences. And I think that I think the basic rule of the discussion of ethics rules is that they should not be a weapon in an unrelated policy debate. And I think on the question of the on the torture memos, I I agree 100% that there should have been, but any private sector lawyer is good for private sector lawyers, well trained in, and that is, this is a should opinion as opposed to a would opinion, and there's a rest of the court that disagree on the law. And I think the sort of a footnote to that is that I think that it is key in filling legal positions in the government that may be filled by lawyers, and by that I mean seasoned lawyers who have practice. And I think that was probably the thing for my criticisms. On the substance of the presentation that Joel made, I've got to say that I think there should have been a calendar here. We've had three panelists who have been highly critical of what went on, and we have not heard any, there's been nobody available in response. Among the things that are omitted in your candid discussions is any discussion of the impact of the authorization for this military force resolution. That's pointed out some additional arguments that could be made. And I don't mean to get into the substance of that. Let me also say that just from a very far off observer of what went on in this controversy is that I think as one explores the role of military lawyers, I think two things jump out at me. One, I hear a lot of the position, one of the strongest positions that they've taken is that we should not do this. And that goes back to the agency question. And I think that it's not the lawyer's role to give the policy advice. And as someone who has been in a general counsel position in government, to get advice from your lawyers that you need to translate into and pass on as your own advice, there's nothing worse and more dangerous to have policy issues entangled in that. I don't mind if somebody wants to make the policy issues on the side, what have you, but at the end of the day, the lawyer is there to render lawyer advice. The lawyer is there to, I believe, give the client the maximum options to make its client's policy decisions. On the role of the military, I think there's a policy issue there. The second thing is that I think we saw a reliance on historical issues and historical facts and an unwillingness to deal. Now, this is very anecdotal with a new set of facts. This is very anecdotal. I was right after 9/11, I was on a panel, and I was sitting next to a JAG colonel, who was wringing his hands over the rules of engagement in a domestic context, which is what we had in 9/11. And I looked over his notebook, and he was reading from a memorandum dated January 2000. Now, why wasn't he looking at something that was dated September the 13th, 2001? And I think there was this we're not going to change the rules, we're happy with it. I think you need to say for another day, but I'd encourage you to have it, of a substantive discussion of what the rules are on torture and whether they're right. I mean, again, you talk about necessity of defense, but I mean, you get right, the presentations I've seen, panelists cannot deal with the ticking time bomb exception. Everything from you're just going to ignore it, or that's all right, do it and we'll get you off later, which is totally inconsistent with the law concept. Just to go back now a little bit to the comments of Justin, particularly the approach on the public approach. I mean, you cited these sources of where you need to look. The big problem with the lawyer needs to have a client. Needs to know whom to ask, to consult with and tell that they're doing the wrong thing, the right thing, what have you. The idea that the client is, quote, the public, and that their policy issues out there or what have you, I just don't think that's the role of the lawyer. And if I were a consumer, I've never been a consumer of legal advice, I would say. That's not what I would want, it's a renderer of legal advice. I try to keep it down to basis of lessons that I was taught as a first year associate.
Well, I was speaking to government
is that I do believe that the two are almost exactly the same. And I'd like to hear more as to what the source is for a differentiation between the rules and the two.
Well, the private attorneys and government attorneys are quite different for a variety of reasons that have been delineated in Supreme Court.
This is what you're talking about, an advisory function. It's where the client says, why, and a similar question would obviously be the substance, but why would the lawyer take a different approach of the three options that you have that you gave the government one from your hypothetical?
I would take a different approach because it's not the duty of a government advisor generally to advocate or oppose a certain position. It's your duty to evaluate according to the Bible rules of professional conduct whether something's ethical, or their duty to evaluate the constitutionality of it, not to go in as the SG would and advocate for or against it. I think most people agree that the government advisor has a very different role than a litigator who's appearing in a court.
I'm not talking about the litigator. I'm not talking about the advocacy role. I'm talking about the advisory roles of the private sector versus the
I don't know that, well, Kathleen can speak to this. I don't know much about advising in the private sector because I've never been a private sector advisor advising maybe a corporation on what it needs to do. But as a government advisor, I think you do have to take into account the public interest and not just what your boss, what the president wants to do, or what the attorney general himself wants to do and how to get around that and how to do that.
If I could chime in here. Ms. Williams, I think that you raised an important point. That is, Jekyll has advocated sort of public interest approach for government lawyers. This is a controversial position. It's not sort of held by all people who have looked at this issue. And I think that there are some strong arguments against the public interest approach, and I think that you were alluding to some of them, perhaps. That is, if a lawyer thinks about think that their loyalty needs to be to the public at large or the public interest, it may be that that doesn't sufficiently constrain the lawyer, and the lawyer would take too much control, would make policy decisions or shape legal advice so that it's consistent with the lawyer's policy preferences, rather than giving accurate legal advice and then adding as an addendum, and by the way, my policy preference. Or there are good policy reasons to, you know, take this approach. So I think that it's, you know, I'm not an advocate of the public interest approach. There have been a number, I think, of interesting and
excitement. I really do think this substance of the torture wounds is a totally separate and a long-term discussion and a value. And kind of, I think, get all that and move on back to that.
Can I maybe move off it slightly? Because I realize the extreme sensitivity and go back to the military commission example, which is a hot button issue, but not quite as toxic as torture. And one of the problems there goes to another C in a Pat Wald article on what government lawyers should be before courts. You had another C, which I'm sure Judge Webster endorses and is implicit in his scores, and that was competence. And indeed, that at some level rises to an ethical principle. And I don't think in this case that the government lawyers met the standard that you would expect of private counsel. That is, private counsel asked on a highly complex issue by the corporation about security matters where they didn't know a lot, would presumably turn to greater experts. Instead, on the case of the military commissions, a handful of people who knew nothing, and you implicitly did a little barb at Professor John Yu, which I think is absolutely correct, but in the case of the people in the counsel's office, they knew nothing about military law either, Gonzalez and others. Unlike Judge Webster, I don't think any of them had ever served as military lawyers. And they issued this order for the military commission without consulting with the lawyers in the military. Now, they could have rejected, obviously, the advice of those lawyers, but it is my understanding that they didn't consult me, although we've never seen the memo. I don't believe that there is the equivalent of Will Pass, your successor in the legal advisor's office, Will Pass memo on the Geneva Convention. I don't think that a memo ever got up to Gonzalez saying, we in the military think the commission should be structured totally differently this way than that way. It just wasn't done in that way, in a professional way, according to private sector norms. The interesting thing, of course, to me is the result. If a corporation president had gotten a memo like the commission order, and then it had the tremendous controversy and flat negative, all negative, that arose from it, presumably it would have fired people. Instead, the president promoted Gonzalez from counsel to attorney general, nominated Haynes for the Fourth Circuit, although that is a nomination, I think, that is going nowhere. It's really quite extraordinary. The standards, forget special standards for government lawyers, in this case, the standards of the private sector were not remotely met. And your law firm, obviously, and Judge Webster's, they would never, I think, have presented advice to the president of a corporation in that same slapdash, careless way. And if they had, and the consequences had been as bad as they have been, for the President and the United States on the commissions, presumably the law firm would have been punished and the first year associate would be seeking other work.
May I make it, it's not a contrast, but I just would like to throw it on the table. Not talking about the military commission, but about the original concept of military tribunals for the trial of prisoners in the field. That executive order struck me as being draconian in its approach. Then it also provided for the Secretary of Defense to establish the rules for the implementation of the tribunal. And to his credit, Secretary Rumsfeld asked a group of us, including former Secretary of Treasury Bill Coleman, including Joe's former colleague Roy Cutler, and Attorney General Bell himself, a professor from one of the universities, to go help them evaluate the rules they were preparing. And I know I think most of them, approached that assignment by asking questions starting with why. Why does the executive order provide for capital punishment on the basis of two out of three votes rather than the traditional unanimous vote for capital punishment? What was that intended to achieve? What was the reason for it? absent any reasons, they quickly adopted rules that changed that to be more consistent with our system in federal criminal law and federal justice in our society. And we went through a series of those, and I found they were quite willing. They just, the people who were writing the rules simply had not looked down the road far enough to see what they were doing. And they were trying actually to sanitize an executive order that was quite vindictive and maybe would have had popular approval because get those guys, you know, but at the expense of our system and engaging in activities that were hostile to our system, such as torture. We didn't get into torture, but we did get into the level of evidence that was required in a field situation. And we put back in place all of those things that we thought were norms for criminal justice in our society that could be adequately handled in a field trial environment. I don't know what I'm trying to say, except that it's not all bad. There are people who are operating out of lack of experience and interest who reach out for others to come in and make suggestions. And I found, at least as to the tribunals, although they haven't been used, but as to that, they were very responsive to our perception of what the law and the Constitution should require.
Jed Webster, you described words on an insignia on the Justice Department wall that said words to the effect, I'm paraphrasing, that government attorneys succeed when justice is done.
They win the point.
They win the point. And my question is that the same standard and to the same extent would that be applicable to private attorneys, or is there a special responsibility with respect to government attorneys for that statement?
Well, he's talking about the United States wins this point, and I think he's talking specifically about the attitude of prosecutors and solicitors and others working for the government. How do you win? You win by providing justice to citizens who are involved in the courts. There's another aspect of this that probably, if we have time, ought to be recognized, and that is we're here talking about justice. And Daniel Webster said it was the great interest of man on earth, but in a war, often those charged with defending us or prosecuting our interests are not terribly concerned about justice. They're concerned about the national security, and they're concerned about getting information and intelligence that will avoid loss of life and defeat. And I have yet to meet a military officer, other than a legal officer, who wouldn't trade justice, in quotes, for the information that they need. Now, that doesn't mean they're advocates of torture, but they're advocates of getting the information quickly, not worrying about right to counsel, getting it over. The important separation of values here, or choice of values, is that I think that there are circumstances where that is justified. We're not talking about torture. We're talking about other interrogation and other means where they fall short on providing basic rights, but to get the information. And often we've been shortchanged in the FBI because the military people say, I don't give a damn about these things. Forget the Miranda rights one. Get the information. If that is, in fact, the case, then the people doing it have to understand there's a trade-off. And in exchange for getting that information, they cannot use improperly obtained information in a court, criminal prosecution. And some are willing to make that trade.
chairperson. Some of whom work for the Democratic commissioners, the Republican commissioners, some of whom work in the general counsel's office. When they're giving advice, who is their client? Is it the commission? We've been talking about it as if it's the commission, but I think in most cases, it's the immediate supervisor, their boss, and that might depend on whether they're career or non-career. I think you can, I'd like to ask that question across the government. How does this difference, how should it be reflected in ethical norms, and how is it reflected in reality?
Before you answer, can I build on that, if you don't mind? Judy Boyd, Department of Homeland Security, but I'm talking from my perspective as a military JAG advising the intelligence unit that different tactical interrogations in Berlin and also some interrogation operations out of the grave may have moved out before the violations occurred. But it's very different advising a tactical commander in a combat environment in Afghanistan and Iraq and other areas than sitting here in the Beltway advising the Department of Defense or advising the Secretary of the Army or the Attorney General. And I think we need to really realize, to build on the comment you professed made, there are so many different perspectives as a government attorney. We've been very centric here in looking at in the Beltway kind of responsibilities, and it's very different when you're out in the field, wherever you are.
Okay, well, let's take those questions as a little bit of separate questions, because I think they are a little different. Would anybody like to respond to Jeff's question about the career attorney versus the political appointee, personal advisor type attorney?
Well, I'll give a crack at it. At least on first impression, I don't actually think that the ethical obligations would be, the legal obligations would be different for a career lawyer versus political appointee. Political appointee is likely to be in a better position, be sort of sensitive to the political policy preferences of the boss, the client, than the career lawyer is, perhaps. But I don't think that differentiates their ethical obligations. I think that you're right that within an agency, different lawyers may actually have different clients. For instance, a lawyer may be advising the chairman of the FCC or another one of the commissioners, or maybe within a bureau. It seems to me that I don't think it's accurate to say that all of those lawyers have as their clients the FCC. It seems to me that it may be that in one case it's the Bureau or the entire agency, in the case the General Counsel's office, perhaps. But if the lawyer working directly for one of the commissioners, that commissioner is the client in that commissioner's official capacity. Of course, not in their
colleagues outside the country. So
I think the challenge when you're the on the ground attorney, and as a military attorney, because you have obligations to support your commander and to support the Constitution, is it comes to a point where you've given your advice and the commander makes the decision.
Right.
Okay? And so the commander has to live with repercussions. There may come a point, though, as an attorney where your professional responsibilities kick in and you have to make a decision. Do I need to go above the head of the commander or to his attorney and say, I've advised the commander and he's about to do this? I think that you need to advise his supervisor, you know, you as a supervisor may need to step in. That's a very difficult situation to be in. Because you try and separate out trial defense attorneys from the command chain, but as trial counselors, as command judge advocates, staff judge advocates, you are often baited by your commander. Okay, so you have to sometimes take a very tough position that may hurt your career. So it's, when you're really on the ground, I guess I just wanted to remind us in this room that when you really try and put this in practice, out in the field, wherever that may be, whether it's somebody who's advising a customs agent at the border, talking to people or screening people, FBI agents on a case, or a military attorney, you can't be so ivory tower about it and talk about the esoterics of and the nuances of constitutional law. Sometimes you have to just be able to distill the law and the responsibilities in plain English, do the best you can to advocate what the right thing is to do. And sometimes you lose, and then you have to make a decision of do you need to take it further or not. And that's the toughest part, I think, about being in the field.
I just want to put a footnote in here. I listened to an argument 10 days ago or so in the Supreme Court involving an employee, a government employee, who claimed his First Amendment rights were violated by disciplinary action taken by his superior in government in violation of his First Amendment rights. I think the case was called Gonzalez. It's close to that. And questions from the court indicated some considerable skepticism about pushing those kinds of rights against the administrative responsibility and the government structure that the state of. So what I guess I'm saying is we're distinguishing between giving your best advice and then setting out in some way to subvert the decision that's made by the person who's charged with making it.
We have a question. I'm a low man on the total pool at the State Department, but also a part-time law student at 9 years. So this is hopefully my future. So I thought it was important. Understandably, there's got to be difference, obviously, in the field, whether it's military, whether it's embassy, what, no matter what. But I think I go back to the thing, I guess I'm uncomfortable with thinking that ethics are different. It's how you deal with the ethics might be different. But I think the ethics, the rules still stand. And it's interesting because what you were just talking about, when you're further explaining what you face when making decisions, I would argue that anyone makes that. So that has to have those things, especially in a government lawyer. I got a boss, someone else is a boss, I could lose my job just as easily if I go above my supervisor and my, you know, quote-unquote chain of command in my office. When I think about it, too, the question is the difference between a government lawyer, again, given the experience I don't have either, but what I do as a low man on the totem pole is I see all the administrative decisions that we look at each other and go, God, if this were a business, you know, someone would have been fired, a decision would have been made. This is ridiculous. And I think as a government lawyer, when you're deciding, not the same, I guess not more of the ethical issues, but when you look at the way decisions are made, what's taken into account, what's made, the fact that the business side of it, I guess, is
applied for cert to the Supreme Court to get the statute reinstated. The Solicitor General says no, this statute is, the court decision below was correct, the statute is unconstitutional, therefore I'm not going to file in the Supreme Court for a petition for certiorari. At that point, he has to notify the Congress, and the Congress can make independent decision whether to go forward. In some cases, this happens maybe once every 3 or 4 years, I guess, but in some cases, the Congress will agree. I don't know what that means to the Congress, is it the collective body? I don't know how they do it, but I assume the Speaker's office or the office of the majority, they get together and they say, enough of this, let's just let it fly, or let's just redo the statute in some way that will not have the same infirmities that can be done. In other cases, they have hired separate counsel, and that counsel then has to go in and make an argument when, of course, all the justices know, obviously, that the Solicitor General has found the statute unconstitutional. You ask a very good question. Has there ever been a case in which the Congress has won? And I'd have to do more research. I'm not sure that there has been. For one thing, the Solicitor General does not likely And when I was in the Justice Department, I didn't sit on one of the issues where we did ultimately refuse, but that's not a decision taken lightly. And if, in fact, there is a colorable argument to be made for the congressional statute, the Solicitor General feels honor-bound to make it. And the Solicitor General has often made cases on behalf of the Constitution or the statute, and they lose in the court 9-0. But they nevertheless felt that worthy attempt, and they do it. So if the Solicitor General doesn't agree, the chances that the congressional lawyer is going to be able to pull this rabbit out of the hat are very, very slim. I'm not sure that it's ever happened.
Well, given that we have a few more minutes, I have a question for the panelists on a bit of a different topic, which is, does the government attorney have a different responsibility with respect to client confidentiality than a private attorney?
I'll give that a shot. I think the answer to that question is yes. And it's to expand that a little bit, I again go back to Judge Webster's analysis. The government is a different client than private sector clients. The government is constrained not just by the Constitution, but by many different statutes and regulations, and in particular, statutes and regulations that have a norm of disclosure of information that a private sector client could hold in confidence, but Congress has indicated should not be held in confidence, that should be exposed to public view. And so in thinking about a government lawyer's confidentiality obligation, I think the first thing to do is to do what Jeff Lovett suggested, which is sort of disaggregate the question and think not about government lawyers in general, but the specific government lawyer and where they are within the bureaucracy, within the various branches of government, and think about what kind of statutes and regulations exist within that branch, within that agency, requiring disclosure or requiring confidentiality. And it seems to me that the confidentiality obligation of government lawyers is going to be much closer to the confidentiality obligation of government employees in general than it is going to be similar to private sector lawyers. So I would say take a look at the statutes and regulations for government, and that, I think, the touchstone government lawyers' confidentiality obligation.
And I would just like to underline what Kathleen said. I mean, the rule itself, the language of Rule 1.6, which governs confidentiality, has specifically written into the rule now that you can breach confidentiality in order to prevent client crimes or frauds reasonably certain to cause substantial economic injury. And I think the Rules Committee, when they were working on that, I know, on that particular provision, that was geared towards helping people comply with the Sarbanes-Oxley law, which had specific provisions about when you report up, for how long you report up, and when you change to that rule, 1.6 on confidentiality, says, or to comply with other law. And I believe a lot of people think that that would embrace something like the whistleblower protection law, which allows you to report out or make a disclosure when you have a reasonable belief that certain government conduct evidences fraud, waste, and abuse. So I think the rule itself has been expanded in light of the Enron scandal, in light of the whistleblowers of the year, and wanting to encourage lawyers to do the right thing rather than keep quiet. Any other questions? We have about 10 more minutes.
Somebody else wants to go.
All right, we'll call on you. Oh, we do have
to. Actually, I just want to address the two concerns Mr. Winston's had. My name is Brad Moss. I'm the president of the National Security and Law Society, and I put together this panel, so I feel I should address the two concerns. I'm very proud of the panel, and I don't think there's a reason not to be. However, I do understand and respect the concern you had about the lack of a spirited counterpoint. And since NSLS is a nonpartisan international student organization, we always pride ourselves on trying to provide that counterpoint. Unfortunately, because of the very sensitive, very controversial nature of this issue, every single former and current senior legal attorney who had anything to do with any of this since 9/11 has respectfully declined. I won't say their names, I'm sure you know most of them, and some of them we knew through other friends and associates. And I, as a law student who, for finding it is, in a few months will become a lawyer, I have to respect that desire not to appear publicly on this issue. So respect that, unfortunately, I couldn't do anything about it. On the other issue, I don't usually like to plug NSLS, but I will do it on this one. You mentioned the desire for a substantive discussion on point-counterpoint regarding torture and interrogation. I can proudly say this has been discussed. It's been discussed here at the law school. NSLS put on a conference last March called Emerging Issues in International and National Security, and one of our panels was on torture, interrogation, and human rights. It was point-counterpoint. We had Lisa Massimino, who's a professor here, and is the Washington Director of Human Rights First, as well as Professor Robert Goldman, to point-counterpoint with Harvey Ryshnikov from the National War College. Harvey Ryshnikov was defending Bush administration's policies. That can be found on C-SPAN, which is also airing this live on C-SPAN 3. It can be purchased by VHS or DVD as well. We have rights, we don't. As well, NSLS is putting out a proceedings of all the panels from that conference, which will be a very, very low cost, I think about $17, will be coming out, God willing, in before Christmas break. So if you want to read more about that, I just direct you to that.
Does anybody else have a question we haven't asked a question? Okay, well then, happy to receive your question.
I was just going to make a couple of comments on the question of, you know, who the lawyer, the client is and so forth. And I think it's important not to confuse organizational aspects with the basic ethical issue of who the client is and how one delivers legal advice is something you need to keep in mind in how you do it, and have to make sure that your organizational is set up so that you don't have a infringement on anybody's ethical issue. On the question of the tactical field advice, I would very much disagree with what I heard Justin saying, that the lawyer has different obligations. It seems to me that the ethical role of the lawyer is exactly the same whether you're sitting outside of the Oval Office or whether you're, you know, next door to the guy who's getting ready to pull the trigger.
I don't think any lawyers were actually out in the field. I wasn't trying to say that lawyers who happen to be located in Afghanistan have different ethical obligations. That was not what I was trying to say. I was trying to say the lawyers in the field were communicating very closely with the lawyers inside the Beltway. And that while I haven't served in the military, and so I don't contest the unique military experience, and that often when you're in the battlefield, you may have to make split-second decisions about things and may not have time to go and consult with Washington. That's not what we're talking about when we're talking about the torture.
What I was going to say is I confidentiality point, in my recollection is that 1-6 applies to ex-government, thinking of the terms of the ex-war, ex-government war, back in the private sector. So I don't think the disclosure is in the same way. I think that 1-6 still applies. 1-11 has deals, which is the revolving door room, which is another issue that you might devote one of your comments to. Governs what you can do with that information. I think the government is different from the private sector client, and there's very little that the government can keep confidential. It has to be, national security issues, classified information, the Freedom of Information Act is available. Somebody can go get that information, but you can't invoke an attorney client
If I can just add one thing, at some point I would like to hear more from you, whether it's, in front of C-SPAN or not, about the differences between being on the ground and advising the tactical commander versus the more serene environment. I guess I would just add here that this torture memo that we've been talking about, the August 2002 memo from the Justice Department, is not the only torture memo that's been made public. There's a number that have not been made public, but there's one from a JAG lawyer in Guantanamo who does some legal analysis of torture and the Eighth Amendment and application of the Constitution in Guantanamo, and is problematic in somewhat different ways than the Justice Department memo. And as someone who sort of took some time to kind of go after that Justice Department memo, I looked at the one more tactical memo and was not favorably impressed with its legal analysis. But one of the reasons I decided not to sort of go after it the way I've gone after the Justice Department one is that, presumably someone at Guantanamo didn't have the time to write a 60-page memo that the OLC lawyers did. And so, besides the time constraints that certainly apply at the practical level, I guess I just think that you've raised an intriguing question that I hope we'll hear more from.
Well, I won't go into the deliberative process, so to speak, of what was going on between commanders and their advisors and things like that that would be appropriate for you to talk about. But I will say that I come from an Army background, so my comments should be construed from that perspective. That's the way I was trained, and I serve as a reservist now. When you are an Army JAG, you get a lot of different kinds of experiences that build upon each other. And the goal is, by the time you serve 20 years, then you are a senior attorney who can then advise like a general of many stars and a wide variety of responsibilities. But the benefit of being an entry-level attorney in the military, and certainly in the Army, is that it's like your feet are in the fire. You're in there and you have to operate under a wide variety of circumstances. Things are moving quickly. And you're very far from Washington. That's not really what you think about when looking at answers, to be frank. That's probably the last thing you think about is, well, what's happening in D.C.? You're more concerned with what's happening in your immediate command, maybe two echelons above at the highest that you would look at. And you're also learning. You're gaining your competency in various areas. So you're looking to your senior attorneys for advice. And they're building upon their experiences that they've had. And there's a lot of discussion between the different levels of attorneys and mentorship and getting experience. I raised the issue about being in a field is different than in D.C. It goes both ways. You would hope that attorneys that are serving as government advisors at the senior level would have some experience that they can draw upon, whether it's experience in the private sector and advising corporations, or military experience and advising a commander and being out in a field environment where things are not routine. But that doesn't always happen. Likewise, when somebody's out in the field, they don't have that outside perspective of what is happening at the 65,000-foot elevation and how does the action of Mike over Saddam's face.